Let's turn on. By that, I mean the power of the mind.
Power of the mind.
Power of the mind.
Power of the mind.
Most of us like scary stories because we like feeling scared. When there is no real danger, feeling scared is fun. The best time for these stories is at night, in front of a fire, or in the dark. Tell them slowly and quietly, and everyone will have a good time.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to a special Halloween episode of the Bookhouse Boys. I'm Matt Howell.
I'm Jason Farrell.
I'm Dave Aloisi.
I'm Jason Farrell again, and we have a special guest for our third annual Halloween episode, our friend Lawrence Rosales. Hi, Lawrence.
Hi, Lawrence.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Great, thank you.
Good.
Wonderful.
We thought we'd bring him on tonight to talk about our book of the month, which is The Great God Pan by Arthur Machen. And then, as you'll find out, Lawrence is no stranger to the horror genre in general himself. And we'll talk about some other horror-related things. Lawrence, why don't you tell us a little bit about the podcast that you do, which is at least partly horror-related, and just kind of in general who you are and what you do in the realm of podcasting.
In podcasting, I run the show New Worlds. It's a short story podcast. It comes out supposedly every other week. Lately, more of a once a month, because there's kind of a lot of work that goes into it. But basically, every other week or whenever it comes out, I read a short story. It's either written by someone like Jason or Dave, who have been on the program, or it's written by myself. And at the end, if we have a guest, they come on and do an interview and we discuss the story and some other things about writing. And if it's just me, then we just fade out to music and you get a free genre fiction short story.
And I recommend it.
Yeah, absolutely. But you talked about the production, all the work that goes into that. The production values on that show are top notch.
Yes.
Wonderful, yeah, he does a great job with that. Some economical use of appropriate sound effects. I liked that you didn't use what I would say would be too many.
Right.
You know, like everything in the story that would have a sound. So it's like, it's not like a radio play from the
40s. No. Right.
It was nice ambient sound.
Atmospheric. Yeah. Yeah.
It was a little bit of a back and forth about, how it was going to all play out. But, when I started adding as long as I kept it slight, like you guys were saying, I thought I added something to it. It's kind of some audio cues to kind of keep the listener on track to a certain degree.
Yeah.
And so far it's been working out. I think people respond to it. And now it's at the point that when I have guests on to do a story, if they've listened to the show before, I definitely don't want to let them down, you know. So,
so
you keep doing it because it's a rabbit hole. It's real easy to fall down the rabbit hole of, you know, what should be about a 2-hour project can turn into a day.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you can tell where all the work goes, though. And you read all the stories yourself, right?
Yes, which I've slowly gotten better at.
Or at least so far you have read all the stories yourself.
When I submit my story, I'm reading it. Is that okay?
Hey, okay. I would love that.
I was also going to do my own music and Foley stuff for here and there.
Hey, that sounds amazing.
So I just give you an MP3 and you put a wrapper on it.
Yep, I send it to Bob of the Earth 2 podcast, and he throws it up on the feed.
But you're going to interview me, right?
So that was a promise.
Oh, yes, so definitely. We will definitely do that part. Too.
I got to put it out there, otherwise I won't do it.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. It's one of my favorite parts. You know, I've gotten to talk to recently we had, I talked to you guys over on the West Coast. We had Kasania from up on the West Coast where you guys are as well. And she has a lot of stuff out there. Leah Beth, who works for Lit Reactor. Recently, we had a young man on from Australia. It's really fun to talk to everybody. Am I here?
Now you are.
There you go.
You were just
gone. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that's all I had.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
So do you want to tell people where to find that?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, of course. You'll find it at earth2network.podbean.com, or you can just search Earth 2 Network on iTunes and look for New Worlds. The new episode just came out today. It just got posted, I think, a few minutes ago. It's called The Ice Pit Cure, and it's loosely based on Walter Freeman, who went around the country in what he called his lobotomobile, essentially stabbing people. Yes, he did call it that. He was a bit of a showman. Yeah, and he went around the country stabbing people in the eye, including a Kennedy.
Whoa.
Wow.
Who?
A Kennedy.
A Kennedy. I'm surprised I haven't.
Who apparently had temperamental problems, but afterwards was in a mental home where she later died early.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
And, the story is about his last days at a retirement home and a very ungrateful grandson.
Who wrote this?
This was one of mine.
Oh, cool.
Awesome. So I think this is Lawrence is the first writer we've had on as a guest, isn't that right?
I don't know. I don't think we've asked people whether.
Yeah, but
Yepa writes academic papers.
That's true. Yeah.
That's true.
Yes. Depending how loosely you use that word, then sure, I'm a writer.
Hey, you published some stories?
No, I enjoy it. I'm a fan of writing. It's my hobby. I love it.
That is awesome.
Yeah.
So, Matt.
Yes, sir.
Shall we, do we want to get into the Great God Pan? Then?
Yeah. Let's get into the Great God Pan. So this was my selection, and this is a book. I've looked online to see how you pronounce his last name.
Mackin is what I found. But
The last one, it's Welsh, and I understand the Welsh pronunciation is Machen, like May and Chin. But the first book I read by this guy, there was some reviews from the day that, you know, around the times it was published in there, and someone tried to make a pun, like, Arthur has the makings of a good writer, so I don't know how the hell you pronounce his name. But anyway, so I first heard about this guy through being a Lovecraft geek. So I love Lovecraft. I love reading about Lovecraft, and I love reading about Lovecraft talking about people that influenced him. So this name came up to me pretty early on, along with Algernon Blackwood, William Hope Hodgson.
Algernon Blackwood, that sounds like a character in an H.P. Lovecraft.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it?
A guy who lives in it on a hill and does secret rites. Yeah.
Well, he's a great writer, great short story writer. So the first book I picked
is
up by...
Is Arthur Machen great?
Or... he has the makings of a great writer. so the first one I picked up by him was called The Three Imposters, and I preferred over this one. It's a creepy little narrative. To discuss it too much actually gives away some of it, so I would just say that it's got a very disturbing kind of wrapper where the story starts in media
like
res.
Wrapper or more of like a...
With a double, like bookends. It starts in media res with this kind of sinister scene, and then it goes and tells these three short stories, and then the ending, you return to that original ending, and the context gives it a whole new horrible disturbing kind of twist that you didn't realize the entire time you're reading it. So I like that one a lot more. But this one is a lauded book by Lovecraft said it was one of his favorites, and Stephen King said it was indispensable as far as, you know, being groundbreaking and this and that. So I wanted to read it, and this was my first time. So thanks for taking the journey with me.
Yeah.
Sure.
So I'll briefly... Yeah, I'll briefly describe the narrative. So it starts with Professor...
Dr. Raymond.
It was Dr. Raymond.
And he's the one that does the procedure?
Yep.
Yeah.
And then there's Clark.
Yep. Mr. Clark.
And he assists...
The picture is the guy from The Thing.
Who, Kurt Russell?
No, Clark.
Oh, Clark from The Thing.
He's the guy with the... I think he's the dog guy.
I don't remember other names.
There's Windows. There's Clark. There's,
seen that movie.
I don't know. I watch it all the time.
You should watch. Yeah, you should watch it like every other week. It's great.
Yeah.
Can't make it through that dog scene. It makes me gag, man. It's so gross.
Let's just. I'll just give kind of an overarching, kind of real quick recap of the story so people that might not have read it yet can understand what we're talking about, and then we'll just kind of get critical. So those two guys, what were their names again? Raymond?
Yeah. The listeners remember.
Sure. So he wants to basically perform this minor brain surgery that
Minor? Is that your word or his?
Mine. That alters, that kind of restores the brain or removes these limitations that the brain has so that you are fully aware of everything. So think like From Beyond, like H.P. Lovecraft. You know, you can see all right. these other beings on these planes around you and everything else. And they
see
perform the
dimensions.
And you know, in his fatherly, lovely way, he raised this little street urchin from a little girl up to a beautiful young woman, and he decides to perform this on her.
And
so
he says, pretty much, I can do whatever I want to
because I raised you.
I raised her from an urchin.
Right. Yeah. So they performed.
That was the most disturbing part.
It was
pretty
bad.
It
was right off the bat.
No, I was like, I don't like this Dr.
What so he's yeah, he's a little Herbert West, I think.
I was glad that he was like barely sorry for that at the end, you know.
Yeah,
you
he was like,
you
know,
hear it out of his own mouth,
that might have been a bad idea. That's the best close you're gonna get to an apology or admission of guilt or something. But so they perform the surgery, and it works, and she pretty much instantly goes mad, right?
Yeah
I would say unbeknownst to them it works.
Oh, nice. So I'm sorry. Yeah, I wasn't being very clear. So his hope is to – he's also got this interest in the Greek and Roman god of Pan, which is associated with the woodlands and the darkness and the wildness of nature and this whole kind of Dionysian kind of opposite of like Apollonian and civilized and you know, decorum. It's this Pan is revelry. He's fucking. He's drinking wine. That's what Pan is. And he, you know, Pan is
none of which is explained in the story. But yeah, that's what he is.
But there people had classical educations back then, so
that's a good point.
You know, Pan has usually little horns as he's depicted, and he has goat legs. Often playing a flute, so he's associated with the winds and stuff like that, and just the woodland. He wants to bring the. How would you describe how Pan got tied into his operation?
Well, you just kind of said it.
Okay.
He wants to allow her to glimpse beyond the veil.
There you go. Thank you. See, Jesus. I mean, just one pithy little phrase, and that's all I needed. Bastard.
He wants her to see the god Pan, right?
Yes, thank you. Thank you. See, I'm so glad this isn't a solo show. So this was, guys, my first little side note here is that what tripped me up is after this scene, I did not realize it jumped forward 20 years. Like, it took me quite a while. Did I miss a line where he said, like, 20 years later, right? Blah, blah, blah. Like, I was totally confused.
No, because I didn't know it was 20 years later.
I'm with you. It wasn't very clear.
Okay.
I knew it was
until
somewhere
later
else and some other time, but I didn't. To this day, I didn't know it was 20 years later.
Well, maybe you didn't. Okay. Well, how would you account for the reveal then? I'm not getting ahead of ourselves.
The reveal. I knew the reveal, like, you know, I don't know, page 22 or something like that. So I didn't really care by the time I got to the end of the book. It was, but I knew that some kind of time had passed because I knew she had time to. I guess get off the bed and go tempt people or whatever she was doing.
No, you see, you didn't understand the ending. That's not her. The character that we're going to be discussing the rest of the book. It's her daughter.
It's her child. You know, I did understand. It's Rosemary's. It's Rosemary's baby.
Yes. Okay. So So this coupling with Pan that happens in the beginning of the book actually produces an offspring. And she has a child who is half chaotic deity.
I see what you're saying. 20,
okay.
Sorry,
yeah. So, I'm sorry. I've been kind of babbling. Does somebody else want to
In Fairyland, you know, time moves at a different pace.
That
so
is
maybe
true.
She grew up there.
That's what true blood
was actually like a week later.
Okay.
On planet Earth.
Sure. So, in the meantime, 20 years later, this Dr. Clark, who was a witness to this thing, kind of a helper. He's been interested in these kind of strange goings on, so he collects all these stories about this stuff, and it's like a compulsion to him. He can't stop studying these tomes. No? The main dude, the guy that, not the lobotomized guy.
What?
Clark? I don't know.
What the hell? No, not Clark.
Okay, it's Raymond.
Vildir?
Yeah, that guy. Yeah. That guy.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Yeah,
Villiers.
Okay.
Villiers, there you go.
So we hear some stories. Someone else take this for a minute here.
Here's some stories.
About this girl that was adopted and...
You're doing fine.
Villiers
runs into a guy on the street that he used to go to college with, right?
See, you're skipping a part, though.
No, that's the main next thing.
Well, not really, because I'm talking about this same guy. This is what I'm saying, it jumps ahead 20 years, because this same guy that was
Clark?
There witnesses, yes, he collects all these odd stories, and he makes like a photo, like an album of them.
Yeah,
but it's not until Villiers goes to talk to him that you know that.
Yeah, it is. It immediately starts with that, and then he's relaying the story about this girl who is odd, and she's blah, blah, and then she goes off to play in the woods with this other girl, and this terrible thing happens. Then she goes off in the woods with this boy, and he's catatonic, and you guys are missing, like, the big thing that thrusts you into, like, that she changes identities and goes around and does this serially.
Well, I'm losing track of the people's names. There's also Charles Herbert? Is that a dude?
Yeah, there's also, he was the guy that, the old college friend, right?
Yes. The destitute guy.
No, because he's talking to Herbert. Villiers is talking to Herbert about this other guy.
That's the guy he runs into, isn't he?
Oh, he's not. He's an old society friend. He's not. The college friend is the one that's destitute.
Lawrence!
Yes.
Whoa. What happens in this book?
The names confused, but...
Yeah, the names
right
are...
Right after the surgery, we drop in on, I believe... Who is this? Mr. Clark is who we drop into immediately because it's Mr. Clark's memoirs,
yes.
Part two. And that's where we really start to find out about the young girl in the woods, which I kind of thought was the creepiest part of the story.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Clark kind of has this occult detective thing going on where he's kind of collecting all of these. He's kind of making a scrapbook and it all ends with the scratchings into some totem pole, I believe, of some sort, something like that, and with some Latin, which I thought was the creepiest part of the story.
Yeah.
And then we find out more about that girl. There's a really rough scene there where her friend kind of stumbles out of the woods, and I believe it's implied that she had been molested.
That's kind of what I gathered from both of those incidences. But the boy, maybe I felt like the girl kind of shape-shifted because at the end of the story you realize that she switches from – she's on the table and she switches from man to a woman to an animal to like she's just kind of doing the – like in the movie The Thing, just kind of like thing. And
mm-hmm.
So I feel like something like that happened in the woods with the boy and that's why he couldn't speak. But I feel like the girl – got
or she I thought she I just thought she showed him you know pan showed him the other world.
Oh, yeah, she did.
Yeah.
Anyway, so then we go to the part that Dave was talking
kind
about
of moving forward
in time.
Yeah, I think that second part is supposed to be the thing that cues us of that passage of time 20 years, but I'm with you guys. I don't know that it was. I didn't think it was super clear.
It was not clear at all.
That, you know, that he was collecting these articles over a period of a long time instead of, you know, a couple months or something.
Yeah, okay.
Well, this was like years and years and years.
Only one that didn't get that part, yeah.
Yeah. And by the way, Herbert is the guy. He's the weird homeless dude.
Oh, okay. It is Herbert. Okay.
Yeah.
So this other cat runs into his old college buddy, and this guy's begging for change, basically. And he's completely destitute.
Austin.
And he takes him up to his rooms and feeds him whatever, gives him some money and says, tell me what's going on. This guy says, I married this chick. She's totally wild.
She's described – one of the creepier details I thought of the book is that she's described as being very beautiful but very repugnant at the same time.
Yeah.
Like there's something off-putting about her but mm-hmm. something very attractive. And I was trying to imagine that in my head, just somebody like, you know, like really – and like I couldn't quite get a grasp on that.
It's the kind of person that we wouldn't use the word beautiful. We'd use the word striking.
Yeah.
You know, like there's something really vivid about them, something that stands out, but it's you know, Lovecraft would have said that the angle of her nose was all wrong or something.
And, you know, for some reason, I'm okay whenever Lovecraft does that, but I really enjoyed the story quite a bit, and it's bothering me, thinking that's kind of a lazy way to describe something, because I was trying to imagine it too, and I couldn't,
I'm sorry. Cutting out quite a bit still.
Oh, okay, so I'm sorry.
No, don't be sorry, but I think we may want... I think that's going to be a recurring thing, so maybe we should take a stab at fixing that. Because for one thing, the point you're making is a good one. we don't want to lose you every time you talk.
So
right?
What are you suggesting?
Well, I just think you should maybe restart and just see.
Him?
Just restarting the call?
Yeah, just...
Me.
Shut down Skype and come back in, bring him back in.
Everybody shut down Skype or me?
No, just him.
So okay, I'm going to exit out of the program.
Everybody?
Everybody but you, me, and Dave. How about that?
Oh, okay, everybody. Okay.
Yeah. All right, I'm going to exit out, and I'll be right back.
All right.
Okay.
Okay.
I love that picture of that dog.
Yeah, he's. I'm sure that's his dog.
You think, is he a photographer?
Actually, looks. No, he's just
that
a dog.
That is a good picture.
It's a great picture.
Yeah. Is it?
It's all black and white, Nari.
It's just a picture, isn't it?
I mean, I think it's a pretty picture. I keep staring at it. Hey, that's why I have such a hard time.
I can't take a picture that good. That's how I know. Like, I'm the worst photographer on the planet.
No,
mine would be like
you're Gary Coleman. It's a little blurry.
Yeah. See, and I drew that myself. So.
And he looks like he's drawn in pencil, which I don't know how you pulled that shit off.
Sorry.
Skype. With four people.
Well, we've done four people before.
It's true. You would think on a Tuesday night, you know, there's a lot of traffic on.
Hello.
Hi. Okay. All right, let's try that. So,
yeah,
could you repeat what you were saying?
Do I sound any better?
You only heard half of it.
Yes.
Okay, what I was saying is David pointed out that was kind of an interesting line about her being at the same time beautiful and at the same time repugnant. And I just remember that jumping out at me in a story that I liked overall. And I thought it was really well written. That I just thought it was kind of lazy. And whenever Lovecraft does it, I guess it was kind of more interesting. It at least seems like there's more effort put into what he's trying to build there. Whereas with this, I kind of felt like unless you can think of a good example or someone can describe to me something really good that's both beautiful and repugnant, I just thought it was kind of lazy.
I can see that. I guess to me it just seemed like she's this paradox where it's a thing that shouldn't be so... There's no human normal way to describe it. Like,
I got the paradoxical element, but I'm with Lawrence. I thought that there were I don't know necessarily if I would call it lazy. I don't know if it was the time or what, because apparently this was fairly risque for the time.
Yes, it was banned.
Banned in places. Yeah, but to me it was overly vague in a lot of places.
Not just that description. A lot of places. I'm glad that came up, and I'm glad that we seem to be in some kind of agreement about it, because
so I read this book and thought I can see now why so many Victorian characters faint all the time, because it's like if this was terrifying,
right?
If this was shocking.
Yeah, I was comparing it mentally to Lovecraft a lot too, because when we had our Out the Mountains of Madness conversation a couple years ago, and one acknowledged thing about Lovecraft and something that we all said we liked and preferred was when he didn't necessarily outright describe everything, but he left a lot of it to the imagination. He hinted at it. You know, the old adage of our imagination can conjure something more, you know, terrifying than anything that we could actually see or have specifically described. And then at the Mountains of Madness, actually, uncharacteristically of most of his stories, describes some things, and it didn't work as well. But I felt like in this story that he didn't ever describe enough about the things that were supposed to be unsettling and terrifying, that too often he went immediately to that kind of a a descriptor. Like, you know, just it was too terrifying to contemplate. I can't tell you anymore because you just it was so horrible. You know, and it's like,
yeah,
what was horrible? I mean, you got to give us something, like, you know.
Yeah, that's a great point. In fact, when we put our little things on the Goodreads thing and we have our little subtitles, I put too terrible to describe because that was used so many times in this book. It was almost a cliche that it was like, and then I saw something and I can't even get into it.
I love the idea that
well, you got to lead me a little bit and let me know.
Which is why I don't mind the I don't mind lazy, because I have no idea if he was actually lazy. I mean, it could have been totally just the way he wanted to do it, but it makes it feel to me like, you know, if he didn't really have that great of an imagination, like he could sit there, he's writing this, he's like racking his brain, well, what's really horrible, how could I describe, I don't know, let me just, you know, it was so horrible.
It's really bad.
It's really bad. Trust me, guys.
You're like, well, what is it? Well, I kept waiting to find out what that was at the end, because he kept sort of playing with that and hinting at it and leading it, and then you just never sort of find out.
Well,
and you're like, well, what are these people saying?
I thought when she was doing her
am I not on?
That Matt...
Yeah, you're on.
Okay. And for a while, I'm like, I'm obviously not connected. Nobody's fucking acknowledging me.
we're just talking.
All right.
I was going to allude to
something.
We're
interrupting us. Sorry.
There was a little bit of description of her changing or whatever, you know, like... I can't remember exactly how it describes it, but that her form is changing and it's turning. It's like, I think it was collapsing kind of into a blackness or something. Mm-hmm. That was about as descriptive, I thought, as anything in the book got. And I was kind of like, yeah, more of that.
But it was over.
And it was over quickly, yeah.
I'll say that I like the fact that this seems to be kind of a commentary on how repressed and, you know, Victorian people were. I think that he was just kind of doing like a Rorschach test with these people and just saying, you know, she had these parties and these terrible things would happen and these guys would see these things and then they would go and hang themselves. Because, you know, and all these people that are so repressed and whatever else were just kind of like, oh, I know what they were doing. And there's probably just some, you know, just buggery and this and that. And I mean, to me, it seemed like it was kind of fun, a commentary on the times too also. But
do you think it was like a provoking kind of thing?
Well, I don't know if I'd go that far, but just like, you know, I mean, like, people back then had a classical education. They read, you know, a lot of stuff. They would have read about the Bacchanalias, and they knew about these things, and there was, you know, you were more, you know, there's urns and these drawings of people, you know, doing crazy-ass shit, you know, like Dionysian, just fucking tearing people apart and all that kind of stuff. I think that people had an idea of a little bit more of what that was like then. So I feel like being a modern reader,
you know, filling in these details.
Yes.
I also noticed from Victorian literature that people had seemed to have a much higher estimation of the concept of civilization back then. Like, that was the be all end all. To the point where anybody who, right, like, the worst thing you could be called was uncivilized. You were savaged. And so to hint that this harkens back to a more savage humanity must have, I guess, been shocking enough.
It's not exactly a new idea, though. I mean, Nathaniel Hawthorne and Young Goodman Brown had written the same thing like 50 years before that.
Right.
Right.
I was really glad he kind of adverted the whole, you know, kind of left the sexual parts of the story vague.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that part really worked. And I really did not want to read 10 pages of that guy describing sex.
It was more beautiful than you could ever imagine.
Yeah.
Okay, so let me just wrap this bit up. So basically, through a couple guys' accounts, we put together, a guy meets Clark. He realizes, they start putting the pieces together and realize this chick is the same little girl that grew up and had these terrible incidences with these children. She has married serially and traveled around, and everywhere she's gone, she's pretty much had a husband commit suicide and had this life of debauchery that was unspeakable. And so this is this girl, and that is the same girl that's the little girl. And then it kind of jumps ahead at the end, it seemed like to me. The character who is leading towards the end of the story decides to confront her in her house and her new identity or whatever, and
and we don't see it.
We don't see it, which was kind of a bummer.
Which is pretty fucked up.
Because then it jumps ahead to her on a table, like we were saying, like turning into black ooze and collapsing on herself and turning into a man and a woman and a beast. And
yeah, and convulsing. we also get him saying, like trying to, you know, someone, he tries to talk him out of it, and he's like, well, I actually already did it, and it went all right.
Yeah.
Like, okay.
Oh, the tension.
Yeah.
Yeah, really.
So, yeah. So, you know, I mean, you guys were mentioned on the Goodreads page that this wasn't scary, and I understand that. But I did appreciate about it that, Lawrence was saying, the stuff about the little girl and just this guy being this kind of occult detective, armchair detective thing, I love that kind of stuff. I love the ending. Like, I agree with Jason that I wish there were more of that going on a little bit instead of this kind of abrupt whatever it was. I don't know. But really, what, yeah. I like... Oh.
And that's something I wonder if, you know, you've mentioned, and what's obviously an important point, at this, the time that this was written, in the audience that was reading this, I think it's safe to say that all four of us knew that this person who was seemingly different people was the same person for a long time. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, when it's quote unquote revealed at the end of the story, that's not when we discovered it, right?
No, mm-hmm. But isn't that the right point?
But I mean, we've all obviously we consume a lot of culture and a lot of horror stories and a lot of this kind of stuff, and maybe there were readers then that it was really like, oh my god, that was just an incredible shock, you know, which,
well, yeah, I don't know how many stories had been written of this variety before, you know, like,
it's a good question. I'm still not sure, and I wondered that while I was reading it, but you know, part of me thinks it's like any other kind of horror. I mean, I know you're saying that we could be jaded by now, but it's just like, why would this writer be pointing at these things and following this narrative if it didn't tie in somehow? Like, there's just a logic that even 130 years ago, think it would,
right,
be there.
It helps the fact that this story is told the way that it is because we're only introduced to characters that are obviously directly germane to the tale that they're telling.
Yes.
Because it's a tale that they're telling. And so there are quite literally no red herrings,
right,
of any kind.
Right.
You know,
but the fact that we're being told it by the narrator or by the author means it must be important. So your brain struggles to make sense of it.
Yeah. Although they themselves, yeah, while they're doing that, they don't realize it. Like,
oh, welcome to horror narratives.
People were going into the cellar a long time ago.
Yeah.
So odd to me was the inclusion actually of the first two chapters, because the first two chapters sort of explained everything else. And then, yeah, the rest of it was like, now there's this great mystery, and you're like, oh, no,
that's true.
You already explained everything in the first two chapters.
Well, yeah. He didn't want to terrify his readers. He didn't want to, you know, make them faint or give them heart attacks. So he's like, all right, guys, this is what's going on. And now, no, I don't know. That's a good point. Like, if you're gonna build up your mystery, maybe don't explain the ending in the beginning.
So, I mean, I don't want to say I didn't find it. I can't say I found it scary, but I did think there were a lot of creepy details in it.
Yeah.
I saw a lot of I thought there were some good paragraphs and sentences in there. I'm saying it wrong, but but yeah,
effective
overall,
passages.
Effective passages. That's great. That's a good way to say it. But overall, the structure of the thing, I think, and Jason's getting at the heart of it, is that, yeah, there weren't surprises, really, and I guess it is something we have to kind of chip away at to figure out, was this a surprise to readers at the time? Obviously, a lot of critics seem to think this was over the top.
I think that the fact that Mary produced with a god, I mean, that was a surprise to me. I didn't know who the little girl was, how she was related to Mary. Mm-hmm. I knew it wasn't Mary, and I knew that it was definitely associated with the Mary incident, but when it was revealed that it was her daughter and that the exposure to Pan had produced a life, that was, I mean, yeah. I didn't know that when I was reading it.
Mm-hmm. It's true. I did think for a while that it was just like Mary herself, like this was what had happened eventually,
mm-hmm,
like what the madness had led to or something.
Yeah, I have to admit that yeah.
Like that crossed my mind.
Yeah, I think that would be most readers. I mean, we all knew that the girl was the guilty party that was causing everything. But we certainly didn't realize what had happened in that first chapter.
Exactly. Truly.
And I know that's true. And I guess, you know, I mean, once you do understand it, it wasn't shocking to me as a reader, but that is largely because I live in 2013 and I've seen Rosemary's Baby and a few other stories that
Human Centipede.
That kind of, not the Human
Centipede. Well, I mean, like I'm just saying that shit's out there, man. You can't unthink that. You can't unknow that exists. Like, you can imagine going to Victorian England and saying, hey, this is a DVD player. Hey, this is a DVD. Really, watch this, dude.
Are you fucking with riots. Me? The first time they saw movies back then, they thought the train was going to hit.
Exactly. They were diving for the floor when they saw the great train robbery.
I think Human Centipede would mess with the would cause quite a butterfly effect.
Yes.
You know what I think? I think whatever these people who were dying of heart attacks in this book, dying of fright, I think they were seeing a time-traveled copy of Human Centipede. Sorry, in England.
So I'll tell you my favorite part of this.
Okay.
This so Austin and Villiers are talking. They run into each other at a club, and it says Villiers thought Austin might possibly be able to shed some light on Herbert's history, and so after some casual talk, he suddenly put the question, "Do you happen to know anything of a man named Herbert, Charles Herbert?" Austin turned round sharply and stared at Villiers with some astonishment. What's my favorite part? So I'm picturing they're chatting, and then face to face, I'm assuming, you know, you don't really talk to somebody like you're back to them. But when he says his name, he turns around and then turns back real fast with astonishment.
He's like Blue Steel.
I love that. I love
that. Yeah, to me, it also implies that he's trying to think of a clever way to drop this in a conversation. And finally, he's like, okay, I've got it. You know, Charles Herbert is.
This'll work.
Yeah.
So for me, what worked best was, and this is what I think Lovecraft took from it. I think, I don't know which came first, the King in Yellow or this, but I discussed the King in Yellow a few weeks ago. This idea of a text or a tome or a spell or a poem, something that once you know it, you are mad. Thing that is not meant to be known. I love that concept, and I love that. You know, that Machen, whatever it is, brought this in through Pan and this kind of raw human, whatever you call it, raw natural thing that just drove people mad being exposed to it. Mm. You know, I have issues with the way it was presented, as we all clearly did, but that's what I liked best about it. And I can see why that, you know, how that was an influence on Lovecraft and King and countless other writers.
Yeah, I agree. That is a good concept, and that's a cool detail.
There was, you know, as someone who's obviously also a big Lovecraft fan, I had never read this story. I was aware of it and I was aware of its influence, but I never actually sat down with the text. And I mean, there were tons of things that Lovecraft took for this. I mean,
yeah, you can definitely
I read somewhere too. I mean, the Dunwich Horror is, you know, almost a pastiche of the story. I mean, once you've seen this, there's no way to not see the direct correlation between, I think, Mary and Robert Wheatley and Dunwich Horror.
Whately?
I think it's Whately.
There you go.
Whately.
I thought it was Whately.
Or Whately. I think it's pronounced Whately, but W H A T L E Y, right?
Yeah, in the movie.
However you want to pronounce that.
And I mean, much like I'm trying to think of Dupin as being kind of the original, you know, kind of thought provoking detective. You know, this is as far back as I go with dealing with someone who is to some degree an occult detective. Kind of someone who's out there just collecting the weird and tracking it down.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which I mean, even you know, earlier tonight we were watching Supernatural, and it's like, you know, here's someone, you know, we're still using that trope. We're still using that occult detective constantly.
It's true, and it does feel very sort of Nash in this iteration, because he I don't know that I quite thought of him as a detective even, because he was involved in the original experiment. I just thought he was like an interested party tracking it.
Well, so,
I more think of the detective as a separate party, like an observer.
I feel like he was more guilty. I feel like he knew, we don't know this until late the end, but he knew that she had become impregnated and had this, felt guilty for taking part in this thing. So he tracked the girl.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it wasn't just he was collecting odds and ends like he was, you know, I forgot the name of that guy now that published the thing. Anyway.
Although there's this, it's true. Although I felt it was kind of weird at the time. He had this, what was it, his book, his journals or whatever it was called, like something for proving the
existence of Satan,
existence of the devil, or something like that.
The devil, yeah.
Like, I don't remember who it was. One of the people that he's talking to that has their own story about Helen, you know, he's listening to it, and at first he's like, "Yeah, I don't think that's actually related. I think that's just your fancy, you know. I don't think there's anything occult going on." And he's not Mulder, that's for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, even though this experience 20 years ago may have caused him some guilt and set him on this path of like collating this information, he's still pretty damn casual about it. You know, he's not like a driven man. Like, I must track down Helen. I must find out. He's even resistant to being told stories that are actually about her until he's kind of like, has no choice but to.
Oh, you know what? Sorry, Lawrence. I think I misunderstood actually what you were saying. For some reason, I thought you were talking about Clark as being the detective. Are you talking about actually Villiers as being the detective?
I was talking about Clark.
I was thinking Clark too. But Villiers is definitely sort of that archetypal detective because
he's the one that's street level, and Clark,
he's the
Clark
street
is
level
just
guy. Clark is involved and he's got all this information, and Villiers is the guy who's going around collecting all this information, and he's almost completely removed from this thing except for having met this old college buddy of his on the street who's like weird and homeless now, and then ends up dying, and he's just sort of bothered by his details and gets interested in the case, but other than that, he's got no interest in this whatsoever. So
Clark is trying to kind of talk him out of it being connected. Okay, yeah. Are you still with us, Lawrence?
Yes. I think you guys were cutting out a little bit, but I'm still here.
Yeah.
Who you were referring to?
Yeah, you know, it was both of them. I feel like Clark was kind of this occult collector, but I think whenever he initially is with the doctor, it's because he's a friend who is interested in the occult. And then Villiers kind of becomes this unwilling detective. You know, he didn't know what he was kind of getting into, and then he can't stop.
Right, and it's from meeting his friend, and then going like, what the hell's going on? Yeah, exactly. Okay.
Which I saw some people or some quotes where people, famous authors, were talking about, you know, the bad things they did say about the story was that it relied too much on coincidence, which I didn't, you know, I can see where they're coming from, but I just felt like in fiction, coincidences are pretty crucial.
No coincidence,
for stories
no story.
To move along.
Yeah.
I guess it's
particularly in fiction from this era. In fiction from this era, like, coincidence is king, really.
Yeah.
In Victorian fiction. Like, if you've read any of it and you have that criticism, then just don't read Victorian fiction. Like, it's going to come up.
It might stick out more just because the world of this book is so narrow. It's like, I don't know. At no point in this book do I get the idea that there's actually like other things going on. Practically, it's just again maybe as a function of the way it's told. You know,
I think for me,
just these people have conversations. The events of you know, it's all you see.
Yeah, the issue for me was that there wasn't much to distinguish the characters from one another, other than their names, which is why I think we're having a difficult time remembering their names and who was who, because there was Dr. Raymond at first, who had that disturbing detail about raising the street urchin and all that, and then you were like, well, this is juicy, but then after that it was sort of like everybody was just equally horrified by everything and equally interested in everything and equally and I don't know that from the dialogue or from any of the character interactions I could tell one from the other if I weren't paying close attention. You know what I mean?
Yeah. No, I agree. I do. Yeah.
Okay.
Did you not have feel that, Matt?
No, I did.
You said you agreed.
You did? Oh, okay.
Sorry, we're all kind of clipping in and out.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Okay, is it possible to take a 3-minute break while I grab myself a beer and we can move on to General Horror?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, you want to do a quick wrap-up of this? And
yeah. Do you want to do that now first or after?
Yeah, why don't we go ahead and do that now? It's just so we've got a clean break.
And let's also...
Austin Clark Raymond. Failures, Austin Clark Raymond. Charles Herbert Clark. Okay.
Let's also restart the entire call.
Okay.
I'm serious.
I know.
Okay. Do you want to do the little wrap-up?
Me?
Yeah.
Okay, so let's do final thoughts on The Great God Pan.
Lawrence.
Lawrence.
Oh, or Dave.
My thoughts were, I was really happy, first of all, that you guys picked this because I think it was just very influential in some of the other things I've read, and it's always nice to get to see something like that. And overall, I'll say, you know, we all had our problems with it, but overall, I really enjoyed it. And I for something that was written when it was, I think, 1890, it was first published, I thought for things back then, it had a modern sensibility to it with its structure. I was really quite impressed with how the story was put together.
Cool.
Okay.
Jason? Me? I liked the story pretty well, I think. I was actually surprised by how short it was. I read this on my Kindle. I downloaded it for free off of what's it called? Gutenberg.
Pirate Bay.
No, this is in public domain. Got it off Gutenberg. Yeah, right. I was going by the little, you know, it's got those little percentages at the bottom in your Kindle where it's like you're 52%, and I got to about 85%, and then the book was over, and then the rest was just back matter.
Oh, really?
And
whoa!
And so that was part of it, I think, but also part of it was that it just seemed to end very abruptly, and I still felt like I had a lot of questions, and I still wanted to know a little bit more about what these people were seeing and, you know, all the things that we've kind of discussed. So I was left a little bit unsatisfied by it at the end, but overall I liked it. I thought it was a cool concept. It's hard to say whether the execution – you know, I've read a lot of Victorians. I mean, we were just talking about Dracula. That came out 10 years after this. The divide wasn't that big. Dracula's 1,000 times creepier than this. You know, the details in it. So if people were fainting over this, they must have been having strokes over Dracula.
Yeah, especially the I haven't read Dracula still, but even the detail you mentioned about smashing the babies together.
That's a different Bram Stoker story.
Yeah, it's different.
Okay. But most of it around the same
there's
time.
There's plenty of other creepy stuff in Dracula, though. And I mean, Poe had come out before this, you know? Like, there's all kinds of stuff. Yeah. So it's hard to say, you know, this is too shocking for the time. But overall, I thought there were definitely creepy details and an overall cool concept. None of them rambling. Jason?
Yeah, I wish that I'd found something creepy about it. I didn't expect to be scared. Obviously, I didn't expect to be explicit or anything like that, which, you know, explicit doesn't equal scary anyway. But I didn't think it was very creepy. And it was the dearth of details that really did that for me. It was kind of sterile. And I was going to mention Poe because, I mean, Poe died in the mid-1800s. So all of his stuff was written, you know, well before this. Right. And I find his
typically
stuff
much, much more terrifying.
He did write afterwards, but the Oliver Onions guy, you know, early 1900s, stylistically is probably closer. And I thought his stuff was 10 times creepier too. So a little bit of a disappointment then for me. I mean, the main thing that I got out of it was I am a Lovecraft fan, and as we all are, well, maybe not Dave, but as most of us are. And it's interesting to me on just kind of that level of seeing where that came from and that kind of horror, which I do like. I mean, you know, you guys were mentioning, you know, it's kind of the cult detective and things like that. I'm a fan of a lot of the trappings of this story. I just feel like it's been executed far better before and since, but it's got its place in history to kind of see as part of that continuum. So I kind of liked reading on that basis, but I didn't get a lot of entertainment value out of it.
Matt?
So I pretty much have to echo Lawrence here. It was a book I'd wanted to read for years just based on its reputation. I enjoy myself quite a bit. I love the secondary scene with the mysterious girl. I even liked the stuff chasing Helen, that kind of detective part of it. That's a little, whatever. I would say my criticism of it is it's, a little, jarring. There's jumps around and stuff like that. But that, I think, kind of works in its favor, because it kind of left me feeling off kilter and trying to figure out what was going on. And by the time the end came, I was happy with it.
Yeah, I'd be interested to see what a second read did. You know,
I mean, it's so short. You know,
yeah. I mean, you could read it again in an afternoon or less.
But, good night.
But just, you know, sort of knowing those things that we say that we didn't quite get the first time around, whether some of the other details might seem a little creepier, or, you know, we might pick up a few earlier hints that we missed before or something like that. I don't know.
Yeah.
Time to get creepy. Time to bring this into the 21st century, y'all.
All right, let's do it.
21st? He promised 20th.
Well, we could do 20th, too. Just not the 19th, please.
Okay. That's where my heart is, bro. My heart being that 19th century whore. You heard me?
That you're a little bit too loud and aggressive for those people in the 19th century. They're just like, oh, my land. He's yelling.
I just got the vapors. All right, so...
A rapper.
Let's do a general, you know, let's talk about what tickles your sack.
I read something, but you,
in the horror world.
Come on, Lawrence.
Hey, Lawrence, you have a sack. What tickles it?
Here lately, you know, in October, it's always a good reason in October for me to kind of read a ton of horror fiction.
Yeah.
And that's definitely what I've done this month. And lately, I've kind of fallen... I've really fallen for this writer. You guys might have seen me talk about it on Twitter. Laird Barron. Is anyone familiar?
Nope.
I've seen the name, but...
I'm writing it down. Laird Barron?
Yes.
I love good horror. I'm looking it up now.
It's he has three short story collections, and I'm almost through two of them. And I explained it to someone like this the other day, and it's going to sound like I'm really overselling it.
He has an eye patch. Probably...
Yeah, I like that.
Yes.
Oh, how
do you spell this guy's name?
LARDBARRON.
And for you guys and anyone else out there, his books on Amazon, if you guys have Kindle, are usually like $12, and it kind of drives me crazy. But his newest collection, called The Beautiful Thing That Awaits Us All, is only $1.99 this month. So I recommend jumping on that.
That's a short story collection?
Yes. And I'm almost through it right now, and I'm quite obsessed with it. It's very kind of, I mean, it's very Lovecraft influenced, but it done in such a way, because I'd kind of gotten burnt out on that whole genre. And he doesn't. I described it to someone the other day that it's kind of more of he creates this dread and fear and this just something terrible is always happening that you'd find in kind of a Ligotti story. But he writes his characters. There's always these hard nosed characters that kind of come out of a James Ellroy novel. But whenever you look at his prose stylistically, I mean, it's very. Very dense, and it's very Cormac McCarthy in a way.
Wow.
Wow, look at those names you're throwing around here.
Yeah,
I see why you're saying you're over.
I'm buying this book like tonight.
Yeah, you're giving me a chub here. $1.99, you're right. So the normal digital list price is $26.99. So from now through Halloween.
So it's $2.
It's
so
$2.
Tomorrow.
So us book owners, second class.
Sorry,
as usual, right?
Do what?
It's all Kindle. It's all Kindle all the time.
But his fiction, I've
you
really
bought the beta, dude.
Betamax.
He's just sitting there with his mini disc.
I got one shelf at the store, and all it's got is Mr. Mom and Halloween 4 on it.
Mr. Mom. Oh shit.
Yeah, they've got Nook books of his stuff, but yeah, they're all like $11 to $15.
Yeah, and I really never liked paying that much for a electronic copy, but his stuff is really fantastic. I think if you look at any of the best horror collections from the last several years, you can't find one really that doesn't have one of his stories in it. But they're really well crafted, and they're written in such a way that I feel like I'm constantly rereading pages. I'll admit that having the dictionary function on the Kindle is very nice to have when reading his stuff sometimes.
Nice.
So he is
those are my favorite kinds of writers.
Mm-hmm. Oh yes, you.
Oh boy!
Oh no!
You will definitely need.
There he comes.
Okay.
Talking about Bloods, and it's written in such a way that you're dealing with these you know really hard nosed, really done something terrible kind of lowlifes all the time.
That's my favorite kind
good.
Of stories.
It sounds
oh,
like
I can't wait to buy this.
It's like Lawrence fell through the ice, and he's scrabbling to the surface. You know, his head bobs above the waves every once in a while, and we hear him, and then he goes under the ice again.
But yeah, I really can't recommend it enough, and I've definitely been dying to talk about it with somebody. So you guys should definitely check it out.
I will.
Yes, sir.
Oh, I'm on it.
I'm on my your orders page on
amazing.
Amazon right
yeah.
now.
All right. That's what
I'm
I like
not only
hear.
Because I don't have a fucking.
When you say things like Cormac McCarthy style and you need a dictionary and.
you need a dictionary. That's Dave's big one.
Hey, fuckers.
Right.
Hey, fuckers. It's on my Kindle right now.
Already?
Boom. Yeah. There
already.
You go.
Look at you.
Yeah.
And nice. If you don't mind, this is, you know, I like to use the highlight section on my Kindle. Mm-hmm. And for anyone that's listening, this is just a quick. Two or three sentences that I think shows obviously the Lovecraft influence, but also kind of, it's not one of the kind of overreaching things he does where he kind of starts throwing crazy words around, but a short little passage here from one of his stories in a Maggio sequence is, enlightenment isn't necessarily a clean process. Enlightenment can be filthy, degenerate, dangerous. Enlightenment is its own reward, its own punishment. You begin to see so much more, and so much more sees you.
Oh, that's read by a master.
It's kind of Nietzschean.
You got.
Yeah, you can tell you've done this before.
Yeah.
But you know, whenever we're talking about the great god Pan, I mean, right there,
yeah.
you see the influence
yeah.
of
yeah,
you know, absolutely. The more you see, the more sees you.
I like his prose though. His
yeah,
I'm already into it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's
very
got
good. Some meat to it too.
Yeah.
So it's.
Oh, it's – and I think he's one of those guys, the more I've gotten into him and you go look at reviews, it seems like everyone else who's in this genre, who's in the industry right now is very much a fan of what he's doing. And I actually read another guy quickly and shortly, I'll say, John Langford, who wrote a short story collection called The Wide Carnivorous Sky. And I was really enjoying it. And in one part, in the back of the book, he writes what all the stories were basically influenced by. And, you know, I just kind of read this between the two Laird Baird collections I was going through. And in one story, he starts describing this kid, this hitchhiker that ends up in the wrong car, we'll say. And the kid's from Alaska, and he has an eye patch.
Oh, really?
And then when you get to the back of the book, you find out, and there's actually like a whole, basically a story in the back of the book where Laird Baron writes about John Langford, and then John Langford goes on to tell you that they're kind of best friends, and that story was about Laird and a story that Laird had told him.
Did you ever end up reading this guy, Matt? Because you put it as a to-read in May.
Who?
The Wide Carnivorous Sky
I
collection
did?
From John Langan, yeah.
Lawrence, are we Goodreads friends?
I think so.
Yeah, I think I might have just seen it there and added it.
Yeah.
Because it's not jogging any memory for me.
That collection I highly recommend as well, but it was very serendipitous to see him write a story about Laird Baron
yeah,
in between
cool.
the two collections I was reading. I can't seem to get away from the guy.
Yeah. Well, he's got an eye patch. I mean, he's got a whole cult of personality.
Dude, yes. I'm already a fan of this guy.
Me too. I'm superficial. I admit that.
Yeah.
Now, if you found out that the eye patch was fake, would that?
No, that would be a deal breaker.
Would that ruin the mystery?
Yeah, it would be a deal breaker.
That would fuck the dog.
Yeah. That's what I thought.
And very nice, you know, give him a shout out on Twitter, and he will randomly respond to you. So very nice. Yeah, seems like a very nice guy with an eye patch.
Wow.
He got that injury, you know, saving someone from drowning.
Something too terrible to describe.
Yes. Something too terrible to describe. Yeah, almost didn't.
I think I know the title of our episode this week.
Definitely. So those are a couple of your loves. Historically, who are some of your biggest horror writers or horror filmmakers or horror opera?
For me, horror, I guess, really began, you know, to be honest, I mean, most people that won't talk about this or don't say it or don't think about it. But I mean, I'll be honest, whenever I was in, you know, third grade, I mean, R.L. Stine's Goosebumps.
Mm.
I became addicted to this quick consumption of genre fiction. I love those things. You know, there's nothing better than a day of getting a new one of those and just cranking through it. And then when I got older, my mother, you know, this is, you know, when Stephen King was especially at his height. She was a member of his, like, book club.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so she got, yeah. So, well, not his own book club, like, where she got all of his stuff in the mail.
Yeah.
You know, as soon as anything came out. You know, and
six times a year, you get a new Stephen King book.
Exactly. There's constant packages at the door of heavy books. But, you know, my mother.
Thousands something. Sorry.
For better or worse, she never really cared what I read as long as I was reading something, for better or worse. And, you know, Stephen King books were what were laying around the house. So at an age where I probably didn't fully even understand what was happening, it scared the hell out of me when I was a kid. I mean, like, really scared the hell out of me as a kid. I mean, I joke about it a lot in different things. But I kept my feet away from shower drains for years.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a real thing that, like, I lived with.
They all float. They all float down here, Lawrence.
Exactly. I mean, just scared the hell. I mean, I remember renting it on VHS whenever, you know, they like used rubber bands to like combine the two tapes together.
Ah, classic.
Yes. But that's where it all really started with me. And then, you know, I got a little bit older and a little bit more finding things myself. And I always kind of leaned towards horror and, you know, the Lovecrafts and the Clive Barkers. And I've always just been a huge fan of the genre. And it's never really been the movies. The movies, I mean, there's plenty of the horror movies that I enjoy, but I would never call myself someone who knows a whole lot about all those things. Like, I certainly, The Shining, the first Shining's great. I don't know if I could go watch that documentary where they just try to make things out of.
Oh, you got to! It's so good,
dude. Don't
what thing?
I started watching that the other day based on what you and Emily were talking about. I couldn't make it 10 minutes, and I think I was like, "This is just a bunch of fucking crazy people."
Yes, that's exactly what it is. It's like an Errol Morris documentary, just looking at people who are obsessed with hidden meanings and The Shining. I love looking at kooks. I love kooks. Why the hell do you think I've been talking to you jackasses for 2.5 hours?
But, you know,
so I've got a question for Lawrence.
Yes.
Based on some of the things you've talked about and some of your fiction I read and heard on your podcast, it sounds like this new story you were talking about tonight may be an example of this. It sounds like you take some inspiration from real life stories.
It's torn from today's headlines.
Yes. So, I didn't want to put it quite like that.
Yeah, you know, I think I definitely do. It's always, I guess, I always just kind of have that kind of, well, what if this happened and what if that happened?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, from the constant stimulation we get them from the news, I mean, it's easy to get inspiration there. And then even from real life, I mean, I certainly wouldn't say I'm the most interesting person in the world, but I grew up real crazy, around real crazy people and crazy situations. And I feel like that kind of helps make a writer or someone that likes to do those kinds of things.
Oh, absolutely. One of the
I grew up really boring.
Well, one of the stories in particular I'm thinking of, I think it was called Gumdrop.
Yes.
And I think that was a sort of like a prequel to a comic series you were doing with somebody, maybe?
Right.
Yes.
If I remember right.
Yeah, I did a story called The Guys with Monsta. And it kind of becomes a creepy story, but on its nose, it's a straight up crime story based around where I kind of grew up. And Gumdrop was very self-referential, probably more in the crazier parts than even in the tamer parts. And it was a real messed up story.
It is. I was very affected by that story. I thought it was really cool.
I appreciate, because I almost literally at the last minute, I almost didn't put it up.
Oh.
Well, and it's not that it was self-referential. It was just such a rough story that I didn't want to, you know, I didn't want someone to walk away from that story and go, yeah, that was decent, but I certainly don't want to go through that again. So I'm not going to go read The Guys. Whereas The Guys certainly wasn't that, you know what I mean? But it's like someone doesn't want to walk out of a depressing movie and then go see another depressing movie.
I do, but I'm a drag.
So I kind of wanted
Schindler's List 2.
Yeah, exactly. You don't want to go straight from 1 to 2 with no break in between. But no, I'm really glad to hear you say you liked it, because it was definitely one of those things as a writer to kind of put yourself out there a little bit. But
yeah, I can tell you, I didn't find it depressing so much as compelling, which I think is a big difference. Like, depressing to me is when you don't feel like there's hope, when you don't feel like there's I didn't come away with quite that. Like, even though there's sort of a, I don't want to call it a bummer ending, it's leading in a direction, you can tell into The Guys. I mean, I don't want to give anything away from the story, but it still didn't feel like this big bummer, like, you know, everything's doomed, this guy's forever like, this is the way it's going to be, and now we're heading down this path and it's all over. Maybe, and who knows, maybe that is the way that the story ends up going, but it didn't feel like that in that story. And so I found it really interesting and sort of compelling, like the story about, well, the story in brief, and obviously you could describe it better, but it was about this young kid getting picked on by some bullies and taking it a little too far in his
retaliation.
Yeah, retaliation. Right?
Yes. You know, he tries to retaliate, which seems like kind of the righteous thing to do, and it goes a little too far, and then, you know, it doesn't, I guess you kind of want to see the hero, the kid that got picked on, prevail. And for a second he does, and then he doesn't. And I'm glad you saw that at the end there was still some hope.
Yeah, yeah. That's what was that was one of two things that was really interesting to me, was that there was that, and then there was also
read The Guys. Sort of
that, well, I want to. You're gonna have to tell me in a second where I can find it. But the other thing that I thought was really cool was sort of the format of it, that it was sort of told from this kid's point of view. I think that we've sort of entered an age, after all, like, the crazy school shootings and things like that we see all the time, that we're sort of looking from the outside in and trying to understand these people and to see this from sort of that perspective. That's not what happens in the story, but it is sort of that same thing where there's a kid who's getting picked on, and so you're sort of in his corner, and then he just goes that step over the line and you go, wait, this is getting, wait, stop. You know,
you're the protagonist.
Right. Right. You know, I was rooting for you and now, oh wait. and then you still kind of, but the interesting thing that does that, the interesting conflict that brings up, that you're still kind of rooting for him, even as he's going too far, you know, you kind of feel like, well, I understand the emotions that cause this. And so I think stories like this are really really effective. And so, yeah, you'll definitely have to tell me where I can find the guys.
Everyone can buy the guys at monsterville2.com. And just a short pitch, it's kind of, you know, we're talking about horror writers. If you've ever read, it's not a horror story per se, but Stand By Me, I kind of describe it as what if all the kids from Stand By Me grew up in the same neighborhood for the rest of their lives and started selling drugs? and everything went wrong.
Sold.
Good, that's a good pitch, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that's a great pitch. I'm sold.
Yeah, and in Plano, there was a Plano heroin massacre, and Plano is a really small... rich town where
yes.
kids all kind of overdosed. The first MTV True Life was filmed here about the town. And it just has a really weird, dark history of these kinds of situations. But yet every year it's rated as the safest city in America.
Really?
Interesting.
Yes.
Payola.
And that, well, yeah, that was sort of what I was curious about, was that I knew that I don't remember where I had seen it before. Maybe we have talked about it before, but that sort of history and you taking that piece from you know, where you grew up and sort of taking that from real life and incorporating that into your stories and your own experiences into your stories.
That was a weird way to say in a sentence.
Yeah, it was.
Was I saying that was a question? That was not a question, was it?
Yeah, it just kind of...
that was a ramble.
Wait, in your stories?
Basically, I'm just saying I'm a fan of...
You're just mellifluous.
That's all I'm doing right now.
All right.
Well, thank you very much. And you know, you guys can find the guys out there. Hopefully, it'll be on Comixology soon. And Gumdrop is a free prequel story that's on the New Worlds feed, if you look for it.
And we'll include a link in our metadata, I'm assuming, in our show notes.
It says digital copies are available here. Whereas, what's here?
Perhaps Monsta's selling those through the website, but I believe we only have hard copies at this point.
Okay. Yeah. It's,
how many pages is it?
My digital copies.
It's 16, but you also get one pinup, and you also get at the back of the book, I wrote a sort of short essay about the town. And those will continue. Those will continue to tell the real story of what happened, from my point of view, in the city I grew up in for some part of my life.
And what's the projected? Do you have an endpoint for this series, or is this open ended?
Yeah, no. We want it to end in about 5 issues. We're thinking, and the next 4 will probably be full issues.
Waiting for the trade.
So yeah, with the rate we're going, it's going to be about 2 years.
That's cool. That's cool.
Yeah. Ed Brubaker just mailed you a letter bomb.
Yeah, yeah. But we've stuck with it, and it's been a lot of fun to work on a story that you're so and you know, emotionally and personally invested in.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, no kidding. I wish I could write stuff and do things.
You can.
That's wild.
Stuff and things.
So what are you guys loving this month?
Oh, this is a big month for me.
Me too.
This sort of starts birthday season. For I guess September does officially, but my daughter's turning 1 tomorrow.
What?
That's neat. And then Halloween is the next day, obviously.
What? Halloween?
Yeah, Halloween. I'm trying to figure out we have in the past at least tried to do like watch a few horror movies. It's the one time of the year that I can get my wife to watch horror movies. She's not a horror fan.
That's right. You said
she gets very scared very easily, and especially
that's
by
what you're there for, big guy.
So I usually show her like old Universal horror stuff, which is not terribly scary.
Show her the film version of The Great God Pan.
Dave?
Is there one?
No, Dave?
Yeah?
So.
You're on Twitter. You didn't see this. I just downloaded a fan edit of Dracula that restores the film to Browning's cut that he handed over to Universal that they hacked up and did some weird stuff with and fucked the pace up and blah, blah. I'd be happy to shoot that to you if you'd like to check that out.
Oh, absolutely. I just watched that movie like 2 weeks ago.
Oh, okay. Well,
obviously, because I read the book, but yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a very flawed movie, but I mean, I'll talk about the film, that film Dracula, all day. Like, the first half hour of that movie, it's like one of the greatest half hours of horror that's ever been filmed.
I agree with that.
After that, it kind of tanks.
Turns into a drawing room drama.
But like the shots, and it like it's just so eerie.
We were watching it last night during dinner, and Athena was riveted the first half an hour. Once they go to England, she just kind of.
It's basically, to me, the end point is everything up through Dwight Fry at the in the bottom of the ship when they find him and he does the maniac laugh. Oh, shit. And he's like, and you're like, oh, that is creepy as shit. And then after that, it's just like, where's it going to go from here? Oh, nowhere. Absolutely nowhere.
Old white dudes talking.
Right.
Thrill to old white men talking.
Well, I guess I know when to turn it off.
Yeah.
So. Right.
I agree, man. The first – I love Nosferatu myself, as far as a film version of Dracula. I think that
can't beat the look of the dude.
Yeah, and,
creepy.
Have you seen the one that the William Dafoe one where?
Oh yeah, Shadow of the Vampire.
As if he was really a vampire.
Yeah, that was fun.
Okay.
Did you like that one?
I thought it was fun. It was a neat idea.
The conceit's interesting.
Yeah, the conceit is interesting. Yeah. That's about it.
Yeah.
Now, Matt, you've been doing your.
Excited about the movie, and then I was like. Then I saw it.
No, yeah. Okay. I never actually saw it. You've been doing the 31 Days of Horror deal where you try to watch at least a horror movie a day, right?
Yeah, I've been trying.
Keeping up somewhat on that?
For the most part, I lapsed.
What's the best one that you've managed to see this month that you hadn't seen before?
Why you put me on the spot here?
I didn't think that would be a hard question, sorry.
It's 31 days, dude.
It's the best movie you saw yesterday.
Oh, there's like
definitely the restored Dracula cut.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, sorry. I've been watching a lot of stuff. I tend to remember the don't watches. You know, the must to avoids.
Like Primal.
Fuck you, bitch.
Hey, Lawrence, have you seen Primal?
No, I haven't.
Leave everybody alone. God, you're such a penis.
You haven't seen it? Did you like it? No.
Anyway.
You didn't like it.
Yeah, you didn't like it. Anyway.
You can't say that you liked it.
Yeah. So, you guys want to talk about books? Or?
Yeah, I read a very interesting horror story.
Oh, great.
Sold.
Okay, so, any of you know who Theodore Sturgeon is?
No.
That name's ringing a bell. But
yeah, but I have no idea who it is, but it sounds fun.
Not really germane, but a weird little aside. Well, I know you do know who Vonnegut is, and you know who Kilgore Trout is?
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was named after kind of Theodore Sturgeon. Oh. But anyway, Theodore Sturgeon is was a sci-fi and fantasy writer. For decades, and a fairly decorated one, and definitely of the, you know, the fantasy ilk that you would never see a unicorn within a million miles of his stories, and science fiction where you would never see a robot or a spaceship within a million miles of his stories.
This sounds up my alley, then.
So was it porn?
Yeah, it's definitely not porn. It's psychological, social stuff. And
that sounds rad.
One of the stories.
Matt hates it with there's no robots.
Come back when you get a fucking unicorn.
Where are my robots?
I am a brony now.
Robot unicorns. Yeah.
Where's my damn trolls?
if you want to get a little taste, and it's I guess you'd call it more of a horror story. This is one I read years ago, but I had to read it again once I thought of his name. It's called The Professor's Teddy Bear. It's really short. And you can find it. It is, and you can find it online for free. You just read it. But the story I want to talk about is something that I didn't know about before, but I read.
I'm sorry,
Halloween.
I can't get over the name.
It's pretty sweet.
I can't look up Halloween book Professor Teddy Bear.
While I'm talking, Google it and just read like the first paragraph, and you'll see, and it'll change your brain. Okay, so. Okay. What I want to talk about is called Some of Your Blood. That's a considerably less silly title, right? Some of Your Blood. Published in 1961 and named – somebody mentioned Stephen King calling The Great God Pan one of the, like, you know, seminal horror stories. He also named this as one of the seminal horror stories in Danse Macabre. And it was also one of the horror writers of America's 40 greatest horror stories. But anyway, what's interesting about it
is
the way that it's – the way that what's right?
First I just read the first paragraph.
Move on.
Okay. The way that it's told and in the fact that it is – it's a quote-unquote vampire story, which is a bit of a spoiler, but, you know. And but it's a it's like a it's a modern kind of reimagining of the vampire thing where he's not in any, like, he doesn't adhere to any of the vampire lore. He's not immortal. Crosses don't bother him. None of that kind of stuff. It's what it was closest to is Martin. It resembles that probably most closely, the George Romero movie. You know what I'm talking about?
Martin,
yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think I've seen that movie. Yeah.
Okay. So the story is
that a zombie movie? Or...
No, it's an anti-vampire movie. Right?
Call it an anti-vampire movie, but it's a guy.
It's
vampire.
Take all the tropes of a vampire movie, and this guy doesn't always. He's not a vampire, but he thinks he's a vampire. He uses a razor blade instead of having fangs. And...
Exactly.
Yeah. So this is vampires.
It's an epistolary novel. It's basically a psychiatrist. This guy is in a psychiatric hospital, military psychiatric hospital, because he was in the army. And it's told in letters between the psychiatrist and his superior. And there's also transcripts from their interviews between the psychiatrist and quote unquote George, which is the name that he gives himself for that purpose. Part of it is also the autobiography that George is asked to write of his life. Can you guys hear me okay? Because I hear some weird crackling sounds.
I hear you fine.
I'm hearing crackling sounds too, but I can hear you.
Okay, it just started. Lawrence?
Yeah, I can hear you, but I hear the crackle as well.
Okay, that's new. So anyway, as this unfolds, you get some of the correspondence between them at first, and then you basically get this autobiography. And he tells the story. Cut all that stuff out.
I'll tell him what to do.
It'd probably be a good idea. You leave it in where Dave's going, my ears are bleeding. I have to get out of here.
It's a Halloween show.
Riveting. Yeah.
Dramatic.
You could just end it there, like the Blair Witch Project.
Yeah. And then he opened the door and
something happened. What happened?
The headset hit the ground and it was done.
Someone's staring in a corner and then it's over. And you're like, what the fuck?
I never did see
that. I got motion sickness for this.
Aww.
Never saw it, never felt like seeing it. So it's really interesting how it unfolds. Essentially, what it ends up being is this guy is – he grew up very poor in a immigrant family with a father who was who was constantly losing his job, getting drunk, beating his wife, beating his kid, and a mother who just kind of physically deteriorated. And, I mean, jumping to what ends up happening – should I spoil it? Yeah. I guess so. It's kind of the whole point of the story. I mean, I've already said he was a quote-unquote vampire. Basically, he drinks blood. He enjoys drinking blood. But he doesn't have fangs or anything like that. But it's all tied into the fact that his mother was in ill health. And when she was nursing him, she would bleed from her breasts. And he gained a taste for blood from that. And like in his autobiography, he kind of skirts around a lot of these issues. Never in his autobiography does he actually say that he drinks blood, or does he say what actually happens in a lot of cases. I mean, he talks a lot about hunting. He's a huge fan of hunting, and there's a lot of details, incredibly precise details about like the methods of catching various kinds of animals. He finds a kid that has tripped his deadfall at one point, and he says in his autobiography that he beat the hell out of him. But what he neglects to mention is that in reality, he then cut his stomach open, drank his blood, threw him in the lake. Various things like that. He has a girlfriend Anna at one point, and you the way he has all of these ways that he talks about sex, I guess you could call it. He's actually not interested in regular sex at all. Like, he doesn't even, like, at one point, as one of the tests he does for the psychiatrist, he draws people, and he draws her with orifices in the right places and all that, but he doesn't draw any sex organs on himself at all. But what he does do is he drinks from her, and he does it in a non-typical way, because, again, no fangs, right? He drinks from her about every 29 days.
Oh, God.
And you fill in the gap? Yeah.
Sounds like a nasty serial killer or something, man.
Well, but what's interesting about it is he's somewhat sympathetic because of the way that he grew up. And the way that he thinks of these things is not a kind of like a serial killer fashion. He's created a different, very different view of the world and the way he relates to it. And he doesn't he's got all of these kind of psychological things. Like, he doesn't think in terms of, like, consequences and punishment for things that happen. Things just kind of are. And at one point he draws the man and a woman, and the psychiatrist says that they're shaped like pears. That's how he looks at it. They look like pears. And then he compliments him, and he hasn't received a lot of compliments, has George. So he gets kind of enthusiastic, and he says, you can do this with a lot of things. So he draws a pear, quote-unquote, with, like, you know, a tail and ears, and the cigar is, like, filling in. Okay, that's a raccoon, that's a whatever. And the psychiatrist is sending all this, like, correspondence. He's sending all these results that he gets to this superior, who's not a trained psychiatrist, but he's like, I don't know, I think that's a tit. And in fact, it is. I mean, that's you know this before you know about the whole mother thing, is that he's drawing everything as basically a breast. It's pretty interesting, and it's actually more subtle than I'm making it sound, because I'm jumping to a lot of the like parts. But like, when you can read this autobiography and not really get any of that. But then when you read on and you start to, you know, eventually he gains enough trust from George that he goes over this manuscript. He's like, let's fill in some of these gaps, because I feel like there's gaps. And you can see that the groundwork for all these things has been laid carefully. I mean, there were a few ominous things in there here and there, or things you're like, what does that mean? You know, but it's not overt, but it's also there in the text. And this, what spurs this whole thing, the reason he's in this military psychiatric hospital in the first place, is the military intercepts a letter that he sends to Anna while he's in Europe. And the major calls him to his office and says that he has this letter, and he's like, he needs to ask him about it. And George crushes a glass in his hand, flips out, and attacks the major. And what that letter in fact said was, I miss you very much. I want some of your blood, or I wish I had some of your blood. his main thing is that he doesn't want anybody to know the secret about him. It's pretty fascinating.
Secret is to write a letter.
Well, he's not very smart, letter. A, and yeah, and it's interesting too. It's told like the speaking of knowing characters from their voice, you kind of realize, like, it starts out with the correspondence between the two, like I said, and it's very jokey. It's very like they're very familiar with each other. They're obviously old friends. It's not very formal. The letterheads always say some kind of goofy thing, like some kind of play on psychiatric hospital. It doesn't actually say that. And one of them is actually in Oregon. One of them is in Portland. And the other one is somewhere else. And it's very irreverent and everything. But then when he's doing the whole autobiography, of course, is in George's voice. And that's totally different. And then there's a part later where one of the psychiatrists is actually writing in his kind of clinical analysis voice. And that is totally different. So it's really cool. I really liked it. Ultimately, it was a little slow going to begin with, because you get to that autobiography part pretty quickly. And like I said, I mean, it's just kind of, I mean, he had kind of a rough life, but he writes kind of simply because he's not very smart. And on the surface of things, it's some pretty pedestrian shit. And then as the story goes on, he you started to realize some of those things were kind of like there was some, you know, like I said, major gaps there. And some of the conversations he has with them during their therapy and hypnosis and things like that are pretty harrowing. So I recommend it. It's not very long. It's like 60 pages or so. Small print, but I think in the print version it's about 120 pages. But it goes pretty quickly.
I like the way you described it. It sounds really interesting.
Yeah.
And for it does this. Sorry, go ahead. Oh, sorry. I was reading some people's reaction to it, and one of the reviewers was saying something like, in the very beginning and the very end, it basically says that this is fiction. You don't have to worry about this kind of a person existing because this is completely, this really is fiction. And it uses this interesting method of like telling you that go ahead, you have the right to do this. You can know this. This is okay. And it kind of repeats it a lot. And then at the you have the key and it is your privilege. Would you like to know why? It's because you are the reader and this is fiction. Oh yes, it is fiction. And then at the end, it kind of I figured it out a second ago how to move around my nook. You guys know I have a problem with this. navigating my nook for some reason. Here we go.
Kmart, motherfucker.
I don't know why this is. Okay. If the idea of such as George still offends you, why it's the easiest thing in the world to have therapy fail and we'll wall him up forever. Or he could get killed in a prison riot or escape and be brought down by police bullets. Would you like him shot in the chest or in the belly? You would? And this is like, you know, it's fiction. It's so you can have this story end any way you want. It's a monster, like so many of the monsters we read about in fiction. But it's okay because we can just write the ending. If you want to believe that, you know, he was killed in the end and you don't have to worry, then that's how it's going to end. But you'd better put the folder back and clear out. If Dr. Atterbridge suddenly returns, you'll have to admit he's real. And then all of this is. And that wouldn't do, would it? And I think that's why he did it, because I think that's what he was trying to do with this story, is create a person who is not really a vampire in any real sense. He doesn't fit with any of the vampire stuff, except that he drinks blood. But that someone who is, he doesn't have the kind of like, he doesn't think like we do, and he somehow has, his emotional development has been stunted at like an infant level, where it's like he has a need for comfort and then he gets it and he's okay. But if he doesn't get it, he gets even more hysterical until he gets it. And he never really goes beyond that. And for him, the need is for blood. And so at various points, he's been driven pretty far to get it. And that's a more plausible scenario than a dude with a cape who can turn into a bat. Who, you know, obviously, you can talk yourself into very quickly that I don't have to worry about that. No actual vampire is going to come for me. But someone who drinks my blood because his father beat him, and he gets, whenever he feels kind of lost and he needs the comfort of his, basically his mother, that, right. You know, his answer to that is to drink blood.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. That sounds creepy.
That's it.
Creepy true stories.
Well, not true, but yeah.
Creepy fictional stories.
Creepy plausible stories.
So read the rest of Professor Teddy Bear and tell me what you think, Dave, sometime later. It's not very long.
No, I want to read the first paragraph now because I feel like I was laughing at it. But you're right, the first paragraph, it's very short. It says, "Sleep," said the monster. It spoke with its ear, with little lips, writhing deep within the folds of flesh because its mouth was full of blood. That's the whole first paragraph. You're right, Jason. I changed my opinion based on that.
And it gets
creepy. I was like, oh, the professor's teddy bear.
It actually continues to be pretty damn creepy. But it's a story that I would like to talk with people about, because trying to figure out what he's really trying to do with it and what he's saying with it is actually a little tricky.
Cool.
Well, does anyone have anything else, or should I go to bed?
I don't know, man. We're running kind of long, and I've got a lot of editing to do.
Yeah. All those gaps.
Yep.
No, I'm not going to do that. You're right. But
that would be silly.
Now we're making stuff I have to cut out.
One question. Lawrence.
Yes.
Are you a Barker fan? You mentioned Barker.
Yeah. You know, I've never read Hellraiser, but I've read all of the Books of Blood.
I thought that was one of the Books of Blood, or it's a short story. It's not a novel.
The Hellbound Heart.
Yeah, I think Hellbound Heart's separate from the collections, though, isn't it?
Oh, is it?
It's got other stories in it. I used to have it, or I might still have it. You're right, it's not called a Books of Blood. I think there's only two Books of Blood, but then there's like three other short story collections, and that's one of them. I'm a huge fan of his short fiction. That's why I asked. And before I decided to read that Sturgeon story, I had reread one of his stories, so I'd have something fresh in my mind. And it was pretty much just as good as I remembered. But yeah, for some reason, I have never been able to enjoy his novels, but I think he's one of the creepier short story writers. And if you want, he's got some good body horror stuff. If you need some inspiration there,
thanks.
Yeah,
I read Meridian or whatever it was.
What's it called?
Meridian, I think, or whatever Nightbreed was from.
Yeah.
Oh.
I'm interested to hear you say, Jason, that he's a great short story writer more than novel, because I've tried to read a couple of his novels and
yeah.
Oh yeah, dude. It's night day.
Ponderous.
Night and day. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and I've heard that from several people, and I think that's why I've always avoided the novels. But I know if you crack open Books of Blood and just read that first Meat Train story.
Yeah, Midnight Meat Train's a good one.
Yes, that story always. If anyone says his name, that's the first image. That's the first story that comes to my mind.
One of the ones that creeped me out the most, I remember, was Dread.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that one? Yeah.
I read these for the most part.
Pretty freaked out by that one. Yeah, me too. That's why I reread one. I reread a story called In the Flesh, which was pretty good too. Yeah, give that a try, because it's really, I don't think I've ever run into anybody that it was more dramatic of a difference. Like, it's like a different guy. Yeah. Like, he turns like a completely different, like his goal. And therefore, his methods are just completely different when he's writing one or the other. And he doesn't, as far as I know, all of his novels are. He hasn't written any horror novels, and he hasn't written a lot of non-horror short fiction. So it's really, it's pretty different.
Yeah, it's like true. Gaiman,
between comics and novels,
right?
Yeah.
I can't stand his prose. I love his children's fiction, and I love his comics, but I do not like his novels.
I'm sort of with you on that. Though Jen likes his novels a lot, but I can't do it. I'm with you.
I'm the same way. I was a bit baffled by American Gods, and
yeah.
I mean, I guess I understand the pace, but it really was. I finished it, and I remember finishing it and thinking like, "Good, I'm done with this."
Yes,
that's not the reaction.
Right. Something else.
Yeah, it took me two or three tries. Yes. I remember thinking, you're such a talented guy, and it's a shame that you came off so hacky in this book, at least in your writing style.
That's, I read so Ocean.
It's like, if you read Sandman, you're like, this is completely original all the way through. This is, like, gorgeously original. Like, you can see some of the influence, but it's just, like, almost every single issue. Like, there are two or three that I would cut out, but most of it is just like, wow. And then you read his novels, you're like, what?
Who is this guy?
Yeah, who?
I think that
Dean
is
Koontz?
From what I've read, his longest form stuff is the weakest. His short form prose stuff is in the middle, and his comic stuff, or at least his better comic stuff, is the best. And I wonder, part of the problem I have with him at his worst is that it feels like he really needs an editor. And I know he's probably like too big now to, have a hardcore editor maybe, but he overwrites. He uses a lot of it's not spare. He uses a lot of words that don't really add much, and just kind of pad things out and make it, there's a rhythm to it, but it's really long and drawn out. And maybe with the comic stuff that didn't happen as much because he's writing in a visual medium, and he's not having to do everything with the words, and so that actually benefited him,
Yeah, and I think that aspect of it actually benefited him in the comic stuff, because he was always one of the wordier
for the time, even comics writers, like the dialogue balloons in your average issue of Sandman or Death Comics or whatever, and like there's tons of dialogue, and it's all very realistic. It's all very like muttery and conversational, much more so than in his books, which is odd to me. Mm-hmm. Like in the books, it's just much more, you know, general prosy. Yeah, getting the point across. But there was a lot more sort of realism. But anyway, we're getting off topic. I need to go to bed. Come on.
Okay.
It was a genuine pleasure to have you on the show. It was so nice.
Thanks
to
so much
to
for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys. It's always nice getting to chat with you guys and getting to chat, you know, fiction. There's not many people in my day-to-day that can go, you know, for hours talking about books, so it's nice.
Oh, we go for hours. That's our attention. That's our tagline.
Oh, no, and I love it. I mean, I have a good, close-knit group of friends, but they're no one's really, you know, wanting to talk about what they read this week.
Right. It's always helpful to have like different groups of friends.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for bringing up Laird Barron and
That sounds really cool.
I hope you guys like it. That's what I'm about to retire to right now.
Nice.
I started Lair of the White Worm this morning by Bram Stoker, and Yepa sent me a message through Goodreads saying, "Don't do it. Don't. It's a terrible book." But it's too late. I already got like a third of the way through it. But
you're gonna get white wormed.
Lots of racism. Lots of racism.
Lots of racism.
Yeah, not like Africans. Yeah, I am tempted to pull up a quote, but it's where we ran kind of long. But wow, does not like savages.
Just the fact that you call them savages.
Yeah. So anyway, but I can't wait to.
It was a scary thing back then.
It was very scary. I can't wait to fire up this Laird Barron stuff, Lawrence. Thank you for turning us on to that.
Oh no, I look forward to hearing what you guys think about it. Either way,
Is he on Twitter? Is he still alive?
Yes.
Yeah, he's the nice
order
guy.
My questions.
The iPad guy.
Is he alive?
Yes, and if you mention him, he'll follow you and say thank you.
Yeah, he was that guy.
He won't follow me like home.
No, maybe. As far as you know,
okay.
How many people have
a Twitter account who have died? Do you think they're
well? There's
been around for what, 5 years?
Yeah.
There's like Amy Winehouse, and then who?
Well, I could name another one, but I don't really want to.
Hey, I'll say this: have any of you guys ever been to Olympia, Washington?
Oh yes,
I saw that's where he's from.
He's from Alaska.
Oh.
And then he moved there, and that's where I know that's up, you know, up there, and that's where all of his fiction pretty much takes place.
Oh well, then I'll be right at home.
Not one of those.
Yeah, exactly. Guys. So,
yeah,
everything takes place up there.
That is a terrifying place. That's what I thought when I went through.
Well, the way he describes it makes me interested. Yeah, it really does.
I like the, you know, it's like. The idea of any, you could pull over a rock and there could be all kinds of things going on under there. All kinds of, you know, with a whole rip from the headlines thing. I was going to say, and I'll just say real briefly, that I like the idea that it's like, almost like a public service, because we do get inundated by all these news stories, but they're all distilled down to these bare facts, and they could have the most horrible details, but most of the time you don't even know. It's like, it tells you the starting point, the players, and the end. And imagining what goes in between could be a more than full-time job of frequently horror, you know?
Yeah, I can see that. I can also see how they pretty much distill it down to its worst part to appeal to people who are browsing for things like cheerleader's head found in cooler. I'm like, well, I'm going to have to click on that now.
Right, but the story of how the head got off her body and in the cooler is probably very fascinating, very horrifying.
Yeah, I guess.
And but they won't tell you that.
And the guy that did it, you know, like, what? Yeah. Where did he come from? You know?
I guess it depends on what you consider the function of the news. If the function of the news is to titillate, then good. Good job. If it's informed you of potential danger to yourself or your person, then some guy who's already been caught for shooting your neighbor, yeah, I don't care.
Yeah, I still don't understand why they – like, I'll get up on the news, like, I'll be getting ready for work, and it's like, there was a fire in Kansas last night, like, and –
Okay, that's terrible.
Did
they put it out?
Granted, we all agree that's terrible. Why the fuck are you telling me? This is nothing. It isn't local.
Is it still going?
Was somebody famous in it? Like, what? I don't.
What I'm noticing more and more that I really can't stand is if you have a prurient headline like "Cheerleader's Head Found in Garbage Can." What's even worse is when you open the article and it's like, "Susie, a cheerleader at the local high school, was rooting through the trash today when she, you know," it's like it's misleading. They do that too. I've seen.
He's
seen
very
that
let down. This girl.
Like, what? She's alive. And everything. But they no. But you know they put something there. It's like, oh really? Wow. It's not even what happened.
Dude, they're just going for clicks. That's how they get them. That's how they get paid. You got to click through to the article.
Yeah.
See, I think the local news is the worst because they're just like scraping the bottom of the barrel.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I agree with that. Now I'm depressed.
All right, wrapping it up.
Depressed. Yeah, I don't care. All right, you guys have a safe and happy Halloween. And thank you, Lawrence, for taking the time to talk to us tonight.
Thank you.
No problem. You guys have a great night.
Happy Halloween, everybody.
Thanks, you too.
All right.
Everyone check out New Worlds. Great podcast.
Yep.
Yeah, go to New Worlds. Subscribe.
I'm dropping. I haven't listened to that one yet.